Okay, let's go ahead and get started with the sermon here. Surprise, surprise, I'm going to be talking about my last 3 weeks away from my wife. I mentioned this morning. In 41 years of marriage, I don't think we've ever been apart for 3 weeks before. So this was a long time. I was ready to get back home, but I was also very excited about it at the same time. So I want to talk about the dig today, but I want to do it from maybe a little bit of an unusual perspective, because there's a lot to be said about this. I just am curious. This is a show of hands. There's nothing to be embarrassed if you don't. I certainly didn't. How many of you have never heard, before us announcing this dig, the city of Lachish? Yeah, I have to admit, I don't think I did either. I have read through the Bible probably 20 or 25 times in my life. So I know I've ran across it, because it's mentioned 22 times in the Bible. And I think I just read right over it. Shame on me for doing that, because there's a lot of information that the Bible has to say about this, and I want to go through some of that today. Today I want to explore through the pages of the Bible the history of this city the time where Joshua entered the Promised Land and started conquering cities, all the way up to the return from Babylonian captivity in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah. This city is prominently mentioned throughout the Old Testament. It just kind of gets swallowed up with stories of Jerusalem and Bethlehem and some of the other areas. It actually was the second most important city in all of Judah from the time of Joshua through the return of the captives from Babylon. So what I want to do is go through a little bit of the history of it here today, and then we'll go to the dig, and I'll show you some pictures of the dig. This probably isn't going to make any sense to you unless you are a history buff. This I will explain a little later. Details the destruction of the city of Lachish by the Assyrians, by Sennacherib. And it's one of the reasons why we know that we're digging in the right site, because there's so much that's very hard to see on this. I tried to get a slide that showed it well. But the way the city is laid out and the way this is put together actually shows the city of Lachish. So we will go through some of that. Wanted to give you an idea of where we were. If you were to look at this from the perspective of all of Israel, it's kind of right in the middle. This is called the Negev. This is the extreme desert. This is the Shephela up in here. It is an area that is mostly desert, but Judah and Israel have done a tremendous job of bringing water into the area, and you'll see that it is almost entirely covered with grapevines. They grow extremely well here. And you'll see that in a little while. But what I wanted for you to see, and I had a lot of people ask me, by the way, this may go a little over an hour today. I'm just setting the stage. There's a lot of material that I cut out, so I'll do what I can to keep this short. But I had a lot of people ask me, with all of the warfare that's going on, did I ever feel uncomfortable? Well, no, I never did. For one, if you're going to bomb someplace, you're not going to bomb an archaeological site with 20 people on it. That doesn't make any sense. You're going to use your bombs to go toward Tel Aviv or something like that. But to give you an idea of where we are, you see the Gaza Strip here. That is the Palestinian area. And then you see, so this line right here, that is the West Bank. And so this is where Tel Hish is, and we stayed in Netta, which is right on the border between Palestine and Israel. So it gives you an idea of where we were. And in fact, I'm going to show you a video here. This video, we'll just show you this picture first, and then I'll run the video. This is the fence between Israel and the West Bank. That fence is probably 25 or 30 feet high of concrete, and then it's another 10, 15 feet of razor wire above that. When I saw that, my first comment was, we need to get those guys to the southern border to put our fence up. There is nobody getting across that. There is also a road. It's kind of hard to see, but there's a road along here to where Israeli troops can go back and forth. If you are a citizen of Israel and not of the ultra-Orthodox religion, you are required to sign up for the military at age 18. If you travel in Israel, as I have many times, you will see 18-year-old girls with submachine guns on every bus, every train, every store. They're everywhere, not just girls, but they stand out, right? Because, I don't know, a lady with a submachine gun is just kind of antithetic to me, but they are everywhere. And even people from the United States that are of Jewish background will go over to Israel and volunteer in their army for a couple of years. It's a thing of pride. So did I ever feel uncomfortable about it? No. But I wanted to just let me start this video and we'll show you a little bit of what it's like to drive from. This is driving back from Tel Lahish back to Netta, where our hostel was, where we slept. You can see the road a little better there that's right by it. I mean, our road goes right by it. So we are 15, 20 feet away from Palestinian territory. You can see some of the Palestinian cities in the background. But this gives you an idea of where we were in relationship to the West Bank. It's an extremely hostile area from the standpoint of relations between the two. And yet I will say this for U.S. people traveling over there, the number one business in Israel / Palestine, whether you're Israeli or Palestinian, is tourism. And they like American dollars. So when you go over there, they treat you really well. And that's true in whether you're in an Israeli shop or a Palestinian shop. What I want to do is go through the biblical account here. Lachish was an important middle-age bronze city from about 1400 BC forward. And if you think about the way things worked back in this time, the late Bronze Age, this is before King David. This is during the time of, let's say, Joshua and the Judges. The cities had a king over them. We would call it more like a mayor. You know, they call it a king, a melech, that's the Hebrew word. When you think of king over Jerusalem or king over Hebron or king over Bethlehem, think more of a mayor. And these were set up as kind of city-states, as it were, with a king over each one of them. What I want to do is go through several scriptures to start with. The first part of this is going to be a lot of reading, kind of boring, but it will give you the history of this town so that you can understand. But by the time we get to the dig, how cool it was that we were able to dig down here, because you're going to see just how important this city was. So let's go back in the time of Joshua. This is a story that we've all heard. So let me read this in Joshua chapter 10, starting in verse 12. It says, "Then Joshua spoke to the Eternal in the day that the Eternal delivered up the Amorites before the children of Israel." This is, Israel has come out of Egypt. They've wandered for 40 years. Now they're in Canaan, and they're starting to take one city after another and conquer them. "And he said, in the sight of Israel, sun, stand still over Gibeon, and moon in the valley of Ajalon. And the sun stood still, and the moon stopped, till the people had revenge upon their enemies. Is this not written in the book of Jasher? So the sun stood still in the midst of heaven, and did not hasten to go down for about a whole day." You can imagine, if we understand this correctly, a full 24 hours where the sun didn't set. Now, how's that possible? Did the earth stop rotating? Did my physics mind keeps going here. Whatever happened, and we all remember this story of Joshua's long day. But do you realize who they were fighting against? Well, that's a part of the story that we almost never read. So let's go a little bit earlier in the story, back to verse 1. And let's read about it. "Now it came to pass when Adoni Zedek, the king of Jerusalem, heard how Joshua had taken Ai and had utterly destroyed it, as he had done to Jericho and its king, and so he had done to Ai and its king. Now the inhabitants of Gibeon had made peace with Israel and were among them." So the king of Jerusalem now is realizing, again, if you think about it from a map, they crossed over, they took Jericho, they took Ai, they're now heading toward Gideon. Gideon makes peace with them. Guess what's coming next? Jerusalem. He's getting a little nervous about the fact that this advancing army of millions of people is heading down his way. So what does he do? Verse 2, and they feared greatly because Gibeon was a great city, like one of the royal cities, and because it was greater than Ai, and its men were mighty. Therefore, Adonai Zedek, king of Jerusalem, said to Hoham, the king of Hebron, Piram, the king of Jarmuth, Japhia, the king of Lachish, Debir, the king of Eglon, saying, come to me and help, that we may attack Gibeon. So when Joshua's long day occurred, they were fighting against five cities. One of them was the city of Lachish, and it was ruled by a king. His name here is Japhia, and we know from the story and reading through it, which I won't read the rest of it, that Joshua did defeat these five kings, destroyed the kings, and then destroyed the cities. Now, it's very, I say, popular. It's very common back in those days when you destroy, when you conquer a city, you destroy it. That way, your enemies aren't going to rebuild anytime soon. It'll give you some time to have peace. So this Canaanite city in the Middle Bronze Age is now destroyed by Joshua. And it actually then, after he destroyed it, it laid unoccupied for 200 years. Now, think about what 200 years does to a piece of property. Think about what 1 week does to a property. You've mowed the lawn, everything's nice, and then a week later, what happens? You got weeds and everything. Imagine 200 years. What you end up having is a city that it becomes a hill of grass and plants and trees, and it's kind of lost. And that was what happened. After 200 years, something is going to happen to Lachish. And there's a debate among scholars about King David. Now, I want to kind of interrupt my story flow for a minute and show you this. There are two theories in archaeology. One is a minimalist theory, and one is a maximalist theory. Nobody is at either end. Everybody is somewhere in between. But just to give you an idea of what these mean. Maximalism and minimalism are labels about two opinions of the relation between the written evidence, the Bible, and what archaeology finds. Maximalist scholars, like Dr. Garfinkel, the one that worked with us, assume that the biblical story is more or less correct unless archaeology proves that it isn't. So a maximalist will say, I'm going to go with the Bible story, and we're going to do archaeology based on what we read in the Bible. And if the archaeology proves that the Bible maybe was wrong, then we'll accept that. But we're going with the biblical tradition first. The minimalists are the other hand. The minimalists assume that the Bible is just a story to be read as fiction unless archaeology can prove it true. So you see the two juxtaposition. So you've got Dr. Garfinkel, who is, from my way of thinking, more of a maximalist. I mean, there are some areas where he would maybe pull away from that just a little bit. Then you've got another man who, interestingly enough, has a similar last name. His name is Israel. Here I go again. Finkelstein. So you've got Garfinkel and Finkelstein, and they're on opposite ends of this approach. So Dr. Finkelstein thinks that the Bible is just a bunch of stories. And he thinks, or he believes, that King David was not King David, that he was kind of this shepherd leader, and he had a few people that kind of followed him around, but it's not like he was the king over all of Israel. Dr. Garfinkel believes that David was the king over all Judah and Israel, and he does his archaeology research to try and prove that David was really a king and not just a shepherd leader. So there's this big debate in archaeology right now, and it is hotly contested, I have to say. I didn't realize how much it was until I started reading. After he mentioned Dr. Finkelstein, I started reading some of his stuff, and it's a hard read because he basically believes that the Bible, you could put the Bible with Aesop's fables and, Mother Goose, unless archaeology can prove it true. All right, let's go back to the story now. So Joshua defeats the city. It lays fallow for 200 years. And then what happens? 2 Chronicles chapter 11. Now, I'm going to apologize here. I'm still going to say this the way I've always said it because I realized after being over there for 3 weeks, I have mispronounced almost every Hebrew word I have ever said. And in fact, when Dr. Garfinkel mentioned, so first of all, who was David's son that ruled after him? David's son, Solomon. Who was Solomon's son? Say it again. You're pronouncing it wrong. You're pronouncing it just like I've pronounced it all my life. Rehoboam. Rehoboam. I've asked him three or four times, what are you saying? And he finally pointed to it. And I went, oh, Rehoboam. And he just had this look of utter disgust. So, I apologize for not pronouncing it correctly, but here we go. 2 Chronicles chapter 11. So, Rehoboam dwelt in Jerusalem. So by the time Rehoboam comes along, David had conquered Jerusalem, had taken it away from the king of Jerusalem, and David made it the city of David, and that's now where the capital is. Rehoboam dwelt in Jerusalem. That's again a proof that David was actually a king over a mighty area. And Rehoboam built cities for defense. Now, why would he need defense cities? Who was one of the major foes of Judah back in this time? And think about that picture that I had of where the Palestinians are. Who were some of the major foes? The Philistines. So he now is going to need to build defense cities to try and protect Jerusalem from being attacked. Now, when it says here, and I want to read it again, it says he built Bethlehem, Etam, Tekoa. He mentions a whole bunch of them here. Going down toward the end of verse 10, he built Lachish and Azekah. Lachish and Azekah are two cities that you can, they're built up on a hill and you can see one from the other. And so when one city was under attack, they would like light a fire or a flare. That was their telephone communication back in the days was from hilltop to hilltop sending signals. But notice what it says that he did, verse 11. It says that he fortified the strongholds. That means that he built walls. The Canaanite city of Lachish didn't have walls. They had what was called a glacis. A glacis is a steep slope, where if your enemies are starting to come up, you can shoot arrows down, you can roll stones down, you can do whatever you can, but you always want to be in the high position. You want to be in the defensive high position. So Lachish just had a glacis and a moat, perhaps, but they didn't have walls. When this says that Rehoboam fortified the strongholds, it means that he built a wall. So one of the things that Dr. Garfinkel tried to figure out early on was, if this is really Tel Lachish, we need to be able to find a wall that dates back to the time of King David. And indeed he did. Here's a picture of it. This was the first thing that he found in 2016, and it started him off on a road race to try and do an even bigger dig in the area. This, by the way, this little channel right here was an exit for sewage to come out of the city, outside the city wall, so they whatever water that they had inside to flow out would go out and then just dump into the valley below. But this is only about 15, 20 feet long, and then on this side, the wall is crumbled. And on the other side, the wall is crumbled, but there's a section of it that's still there, and it did date to King David's time. Now, how do we know that? I'll go through that in a little while, how you date things. So here we are now looking at level 5 wall during the time of David that was found in 2016. All right, now back to the story. What happened to Lachish after Rehoboam fortified the city? Let's go back into the story again. 2 Kings chapter 18. Now it came to pass in the fourth year of King Hezekiah, so this is now somewhere in the 700s AD, which is the seventh year of Hoshea, the son of Elah, king of Israel, that Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up against Samaria and besieged it. And at the end of 3 years, they took it. In the sixth year of Hezekiah, the ninth year of Hoshea the king, Assyria carried Israel away captive, and they put them into captive cities. This is the destruction of the northern tribes of Israel by the Assyrians. Everybody in here should know that. That's been a part of church belief for a long time that in 721 AD, the Assyrians conquered the northern tribes of Israel. What we don't often think about is, did the Assyrians just conquer the northern tribes and then go back home? And the answer is no, they kept going. So let us also keep going. Verse 13, in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, this is 10 years after Assyria started, Sennacherib, now this is another king, so the first one, Shalmaneser, now he's dead, Sennacherib takes over. The king of Assyria came up against the fortified cities of Judah and took them. Remember the fortified cities of Judah? What was one of those fortified cities? Lachish. Let's read about it. Then Hezekiah, the king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria at Lachish. The king of Assyria actually made his temporary remote throne in Lachish. So after Sennacherib conquered the defensive, the fortified cities, he then turned his attention to Jerusalem and tried to take it, but he wasn't able to conquer it. That's why today we say that that Judah wasn't conquered by the Assyrians, because he didn't take Jerusalem. Now, if you read his manifesto, which all the egotistical kings have got to have a manifesto, right? He'll say in there that he surrounded Jerusalem like a bird in a cage, but it doesn't say that he took it, because he didn't. He had to quit. But he did take Lachish. So during the time of the Assyrian rampage through the area, they did conquer Lachish and destroyed the city. We'll talk about that a little more in just a moment. This is, and I showed this earlier, he was so impressed with himself that when he went back to Assyria, he had a carving etched out of stone to talk about the Battle of Lachish. And it's too hard to see because I didn't get the best picture here, but if you're interested, you can go see it. It shows a siege ramp, which is still there. It shows the city, the gate into the city, which is still there. It's obvious that it's the same place. Soldiers firing arrows back and forth, people fleeing the city. And then when you get all the way to the end here, and by the way, this is one wall, and then you turn, he had an entire wall, and then you turn and he had another entire wall with this conquering of Lachish. It was, again, the second most important city in Judah, and it was well fortified, and he was able to conquer it. So he was very proud of that. Why do we know that this is that story? This is the Judean captives of Lachish that are bowing down before him. And you can see right in here, this is written in cuneiform. And this is on this thing on his wall, and this is what he said. Sennacherib, the mighty king, king of the country of Assyria, sitting on the throne of judgment before the city of Lachish, and gave permission for its slaughter. So this is his reckoning of the fact that he did destroy the city of Lachish. And now it lays in ruins again. Let's keep going forward. During the time of Jeremiah, Jeremiah chapter 34, Jeremiah was around for the last king of Judah. Hezekiah was toward the center somewhere. David's at the very front. Now we're at the very end where Judah is about to be destroyed. Then Jeremiah the prophet, starting in verse 6, spoke all these words to Zedekiah, king of Judah, in Jerusalem. When the king of Babylon's army fought against Jerusalem and all the cities of Judah that were left, and notice, against Lachish, against Azekah, and only these fortified cities remained of the cities of Judah. So it was rebuilt, destroyed, rebuilt, destroyed, rebuilt, and now the Babylonians have come and destroyed it again. Nehemiah chapter 11, I just put this in here. After they came back from Babylonian captivity, we read about the Ezra and Nehemiah going to Jerusalem and redoing the temple. What we don't read about is, as for the villages and their fields, some of the children of Judah dwelt in them, Lachish and its field, and Azekah and its villages. So some of the people coming back from Judean captivity went back to Lachish to try and build that city back up. So that's the history of it. When you look at it, it's a very important city that was made and destroyed and made and destroyed over and over and over again. It's just a short history of what we find in the Bible. Again, the second most important city during David's time for several reasons. It strategically was on the north-south road. There's the Mediterranean Sea, and then you've got a mountain range, and this was the path. It also was one day's journey from a port city, and then another day's journey to Jerusalem. So people bringing goods to Jerusalem would stop at Lachish, and that was a kind of way station. It's a very important city. But after the 2nd century BCE, so this would have been in the 100s BCE, it finally was abandoned forever and actually lost. The stories in the Bible are replete with what happened to Lachish, but people didn't know where it was. And there were a lot of different people from 1913 on that dug in various sites to try and figure out what it was until they finally found it. And that's the one that we're digging now. Now, I want to remind you of what a tell is. This is a picture, by the way, of what the city of Lachish would have looked like during the time of King David. And you can see that it actually has two walls. It has an outer wall, a glacis. This is that 45-degree angle hill, and then a second wall so that you protect it here. Your guards can walk up and down here and shoot arrows down. If they break through this wall, you retreat to the second wall. This is a palace that was built there. The ruins of that palace are still there. And there's another group that's been digging that. We were digging back here in this part of the city, right back here. So turn that picture around, and this is where we are. So this is a picture of that mound today. This is Tel Lachish. The king's palace was right here. This is the only tree that's there. It is where we set up base camp. And then this is where we did our digging. So that picture that I showed you of that 10-foot wall or 15-foot walls right there, and these holes right here are where we started to dig. There's an ancient Canaanite temple that was here that was destroyed. And then, so this is area BB. This is area CC, and then what we did was we tried to connect the two. So that's the area that we dug. By the way, only 5% of Tel Lachish has been excavated. 95% is still underground. So how's it start? Talking about that with Christine earlier, it starts out with a bunch of grass. We have no idea, and I say we, like I'm an archaeologist, sorry, let me back away. The archaeologists have no idea what's there. It's just a hill with grass. Occasional rocks poking up out of the ground, and you kind of look at that and say, okay, were these rocks a part of a wall, or were they just natural or whatever? So this is how it starts out. This is Eric Taylor. He's one of our diggers. And the very first thing that we were given were these spades, and we had to clear grass out. So this is that Canaanite temple area. This is area BB that goes all the way over to area CC, and all of this is just grass. So that's how we start. And we clear the grass away, and then after they clear the grass away, what they do is, and this is a little hard to see, I'll get you a better picture here in a minute, but they have no idea what's down here. But what they do is they set up 5 meters by 5 meters, and they put sandbags. So you've got 5 meter by 5 meter, 5 meter by 5 meter, 5 meter by 5 meter. They just start blocking the area out, having no idea what's down below it. And then they start to dig inside, going down a little bit at a time. Now, just to give you an idea of how this works, so let's go back to the days of the Canaanites and Joshua. So a city's built on the top of this hill. It might have one story, it might have two stories. Joshua comes along and he destroys it, and what happens? It all collapses. They don't leave anything standing. So a city that was once there is reduced to a few inches to a couple of feet. Then it's rebuilt, and then the Assyrians destroy it. And now you've got another foot to 2 feet of debris. And then it's built again, and the Babylonians destroy it. And now you've got layers down there that's Canaanite, David's time, Hezekiah's time, the Assyrian, Babylon, Persian, all the way up to topsoil, which is what we were taking away. So as we're starting to dig down, we've got to try and figure out what is important and what's not, because what we're trying to do, or what Dr. Garfink was trying to do, is get down to the time of King David. So this gives you an idea of what we're talking about here. So here you have a 5 meter by 5 meter square, and you dig down in there, and the areas that are under the sandbags are left. That is called bulk, not B-U-L-K, but B-A-L-K. It's an area that's left undug. And they go down, and they go down just a few inches at a time. So we have, and you'll see in just a little while, they have black buckets to take out waste dirt, but they have colored buckets to where if you find a piece of pottery, you put it in this bucket, and they have different buckets for different layers as they go down. And then the experts look at it at the end of the day to try and figure out, are they in the Persian layer? Are they in the next layer down? Trying to get all the way down to the time of King David. So this is actually, this square right here is where Camille Redding and I were digging. Camille's in our Laurel church, if you know Camille. So we were digging in this area. This was this area next to us. And you can start to see they found some rocks. Okay, you start uncovering a rock. Is it supposed to be there? Is it a part of a city wall? What is it? You don't know. And if you saw the video that I did, that was kind of where we were. It was like, we're finding stuff, but we don't know what it is yet because the experts have to look at it. Now, what I want to do is, and I'm assuming this is going to play, this is at the start where this is kind of in the first week. So you've got the Canaanite temple that's been destroyed. You've got the 90 or so feet that we're working on, and then you've got the ancient city wall. And we started working this way and moving over. I'm taking the video from this way going back. So we haven't done anything here yet. But as I start to sweep through, you're going to see more and more stuff removed to where you're actually going to start seeing the foundations of rooms. All right, so this is the end of it, where the bulk is still there. We've gone down some and we found stuff, but we're not 100% sure what's going on. But as we go further down, now you're going to start seeing buildings, foundations. And it goes all the way down to the very end. So this is what we were doing. We found 9 rooms that we uncovered. And by the end, I'll do that same sweep again, and you'll see all that bulk at the end has been removed because we got all the way down to level 5. We got all the way down to the city of David during the dig. Okay, see if there's anything else I wanted to say about that. I just put this picture up here for you to see it. I talk about levels. You'll hear me say level 5. That was the time of King David. So level 1 is Persian. Level 2 is the destruction by the Babylonians in 586. Level 3 is the destruction by Sennacherib in Assyria, 701. Level 5 is the time of King David. And then you remember I said there was, after Joshua destroyed it, there was a gap of 200 years. That gap is there. And then level 6 and 7 is the Bronze Age. Now, how do we know we're in level 5 versus level 4 versus level 3? You can tell by one very specific thing. I want to ask you a question. This is open season. I want you to give me an answer back. You're having dinner. You're done with dinner. You're taking the plates to the sink, and you drop one, and it shatters. What do you do with it? Throw it away. Why don't you get out super glue and fix it and put it back in the cabinet? Because it's trash. Think about clay and prior to super glue. If they dropped a pot, what did they do with it? They threw it away. What was trash to them is gold to an archaeologist, because Philistine pottery, Egyptian pottery, Canaanite pottery, Judean pottery, Israelite pottery, all were different. They all made them different. How could we tell that you were in the various layers? He used this as an example. If you're digging in your backyard and you find a telephone like in the middle on the top, that one with the touch tone, you're not going to say, oh, I'm in layer 2020, because people don't have phones like that anymore. If you now all of a sudden are digging down and you find an iPhone, right? An iPhone didn't come out until 2007. That was the iPhone 1. You can even tell the difference between 2000 and 2007 based on the type of iPhone. All right, if you discover an iPhone 13, that didn't come out until a couple of years ago. Pottery's the same way. So the trash that people threw away is what helps the archaeologists know what layer they're in. And so what do they do? Every day at the end of it, we take all of the pottery and we clean the pottery and then we give it to the experts and they do a reading. They call it a pottery reading, and their English is bad. I thought they were saying poetry reading for the longest time. And they go through this and they catalog it. So the Excel spreadsheet, this was from, so you've got all of these 5x5 squares. This was from square 3. It was X amount of feet down, and the pottery we found was Canaanite or Judean or Philistine pottery or whatever, and it helps them to determine what layer they're in. Then at the end of each day, they regroup and they say, okay, we're in level 4. We need to get to level 5, so we're going to send Sandilands and his crew. They called them, by the way, the students of Phil. That was what we were referred to as. We're going to send them back out to this layer, and we've got 10 to 12 inches to go to get to level 5. So then we would start digging again and try and get down to level 5, which we did. Here's the group of us. I'm on the left, Dan Conrad. Dan's in the back there. Dan was there with us. Dan Hanisco, Camille Redding, Brandon Burrow. His parents, by the way, have just recently been hired by the church. He's an elder, and he's in training now to become a pastor. Claire Robertson, whom I was able to baptize in the Sea of Galilee while I was there. So I baptized her in the Sea of Galilee, and I baptized two people in the Jordan River so far. So pretty cool. Colin Gwynn, for those of you that may know Colin, some of you probably do from camp. And then Eric Taylor, who's from East Texas. So this was the students of Phil. I will tell you a little bit of a story in case you hear any of them make a mistake and slip. Everybody there doesn't know who I am, and everybody calls everybody by their first name. So in a relatively quiet period, Camille Redding says, Mr. Sandilands, would you pass me an empty bucket? Well, it brought the whole dig to a stop. Why are they calling you Mr. Sandilands? Why? So I said to one of the guys there who every other word was a curse word, I said, I'm her pastor. And for about an hour, he stopped. That was all he could last. So I pulled all of the students of Phil together, and I said, for the rest of the dig, my name is Phil, because it's just going to cause a controversy. When we get back home, it's Mr. Sandilands. But so you'll see that every once in a while where Camille or some of the others will go, Phil, and they'll say it just doesn't come out naturally. So anyway, I thought it was funny at the time. All right, so this is now, we're taking away bulk. So this is Dan Conrad on the left. You see Camille on the right. So we've dug down into some of the squares, and now it's time to get rid of the bulk because we now realize there are rooms down there, and we got to get rid of the extra stuff. So you take the sandbags away, and you start digging. So the first part is pickaxe. Now, when you think of archaeology, you think of toothbrushes and toothpicks. Well, that comes later. The first part of it is 7 hours of swinging a pickaxe. My hands to this day are still asleep. I have very little feeling in my hands. They're almost completely numb from using muscles swinging a pickaxe. So here you see us taking some of the bulk away and getting down. And then once the bulk is all out, then you start to reveal the rooms. So here is a wall. Here is a wall, and then in between are pillars. So this is one room, and the pillars in the middle make it so that you can pass from one side of the room to the other because you have a pillar like every 5 feet or so. Now, the way they did this, and you'll see this a little later on, they built these walls, you know, so thick and so high, maybe 3 or 4 feet high, and then that was the foundation, and then they would put either wood beams or mud bricks to build up the rest of the wall to support the ceilings that were on top. So the mud bricks obviously are all washed away. The wood beams have all rotted away. We're talking about 3,000 years ago. But what's left is the foundation stones. So people will then take this, and they're doing that right now. They're analyzing it, and they will end up drawing pictures of what they think this city looked like. This is another picture of the same thing. There's Eric again. So you've got a wall and a wall, and then you've got pillars in the middle. We found 9 of these rooms right next to each other. The outside wall is the city wall, and that was very common back in those days. You remember where Rahab's apartment was? It was in the city wall, because it only makes sense. That's one of the 4 walls. You don't have to build 4 walls. You only have to build 3 if one of them's already there. So they ended up building their homes against the city wall, and that's what you see here. So these are rooms. Probably, as soon as you see some of the stuff that we've dug, were probably homes where people lived during the time of King David and Solomon and Rehoboam. All right, let me figure out where we are here. This is Colin Gwynn. And so what you start to see now is once they get down, the pickaxe changes from the big pickaxe to, this is Brandon Burrow. Now we're getting down to a layer where it's starting to get interesting. Now we're taking small pickaxes, and we're going a little bit at a time as we start to uncover things. Then as we get even further down, we have little trowels and a brush. The brush is like a shop brush that you would take the handle out. You know, like the handle's right in the middle. It's like a T. You take the handle out, and then that's the brush that you use. So we get down to that level, and then they bring in another expert that comes in with a toothbrush and toothpicks, and then she's down there finding material to be able to take out and analyze. So you start out destructive, and then as you get further and further down, as soon as you get down to what's called a destruction level, so it would be the level where level 5 is, where King David's time is, then you slow down and you start very carefully picking at it to try and come up with stuff that's in there. We weren't the only ones there. We had visitors that came to spend some time with us. We were told never to sit down on the ground for very good reason. There were a lot of scorpions there. I know Dan uncovered one at one point in time. I did too. And also, I show this sign on the right. OSHA would not have approved of this job site. Dan and I both stood on the glacis on this 45-degree thing. We would get buckets of dirt to where we were out of buckets, and then we'd make a bucket chain. And Dan and I both spent time over the edge throwing buckets of waste down. A couple of times, I don't think Dan ever did and I never did, but a couple of the guys lost their balance and went tumbling down the hill, and we had to get them back up. So that was all. That was fun. Here is... Now we are at layer 5, or level 5, where this is King David's time, and now we're starting to get really careful about what we're doing. So this is Camille, and any pottery that she finds goes in a colored bucket, and the black buckets were dirt. So as we go down there, and we don't know what the pottery means, right? The pottery is something that they read later on that night or the next day to try and figure out what level or what layer we're in. So here she is. She's found some pottery, and she's going to now put it over in that orange bucket for them to analyze later. This is a tag that's on one of the buckets. It shows exactly where they were. It shows what square they were in. It shows how deep they were. It shows what they found. You can tell that this bucket was the collapse of level 5, which is right where we want to be. This is King David time and Solomon and Rehoboam. I want to show you an idea of why would they want to have something like a mountain fortress to be able to have as a defensive city. This is a picture of at the top of Tel Lahish looking out in the valley, and I'll start a video here in just a moment. By the way, everything that you see out there are grapevines, and their grapevines are not for wine. It would take 3 times as many grapes to make a bottle of wine. You can make them. It's not efficient. So these are actually table grapes, and they would bring them out, and they are the sweetest tasting. They have both white grapes or green grapes and purple grapes, and they are absolutely amazing. And it's everywhere in this area because of how careful they are with their water conservation. So just to give you an idea, this only lasts for 5 or 6 seconds, but imagine if you are a king and you're trying to find a defensive place where you can see an enemy coming for miles and miles and miles away. This is it. Can you see why they would choose that as a fortification? You could see an army coming for 10 or 15 miles away. And that's exactly what they did with these fortified cities. And from one hill to the next hill, they would have signal fires. And the signal fires would tell them whether everything was okay or whether they were defeated. There's even one inscription where one of the guards from Tel Lachish is saying, he wrote down to his superior officer, "I can't see the fires on Azekah anymore." This was at the time when the Assyrians were attacking. So he actually wrote down on a piece of whatever it was, clay or papyrus or whatever, "I can't see the fire from the next town," which meant that that town was probably destroyed. So it's very interesting when you look at it. Here's some other things that we found, which I think are pretty interesting. This is an oven. You can see just the top part of it. They didn't dig any more out. That would have looked like this. They're still used today where you have this massive pot, and then you build a fire in the bottom, and then you make your pita-like thing, and you slap it on the inside of this pot, and then it cooks on the wall of the pot. So that is a modern one still used today. So this was obviously a home, and this was someone's oven in their home. How cool is that? This is a juglet that was found by Claire Robertson. This is a blown-up picture of where she found it. A juglet like this would have carried expensive perfume because it's very small. It's only like 4 or 5 inches tall. Or it could have had like anointing oil. I mean, Tom and Rick and I carry, it's not that small, but we carry a little vial of olive oil. So it could have been used for that as well. A lot of uses for that. But anyway, she found this in perfect condition. First question out of her mouth was what? "Can I keep it?" The answer is absolutely not. Absolutely not. So I thought it was pretty cool. Here is a picture of Dr. Garfinkel. I was lucky enough to find some mud bricks. Now, mud bricks are hard to find. Why? Because rain comes and it washes it away. But this was buried enough to where the mud bricks were still there. So it stopped. Again, it stopped the archaeological dig in this particular square for him to come over and take photographs. And they took measurements to see how deep it was, etc. So you can see that on this picture over on the right here, there's two mud bricks that are built on top of the foundation. So this particular wall would have been built up with mud bricks. This is an olive press that was found. This is level 6, so this is Canaanite. And this was actually in the Canaanite temple that's been destroyed, but the olive press was still there. The interesting thing about this is this olive press was inside the temple. It's the first time that's ever been seen. Olive presses are normally outside, but this one was inside a Canaanite temple dedicated to Canaanite gods. So it's a possibility that this particular olive press was used exclusively to make holy oil for whatever the Canaanite gods that they served. But the way this worked is, you see this big stone up here and then stones below. They would lift this big stone and they would put the olives in there and then put that top stone back on and rotate and grind it. And then the lowest spot would be a rock that had was dug out so that all of the olive oil would flow down into this rock. And they would remove the large stone. They would remove all the pits and stuff that were there. And they found probably 20 or 25 olive pits, which is great because they can carbon date them to prove that it was middle bronze or late bronze or whatever. So that's off now to be discovered. One of the neatest discoveries, and I have to tell you the story behind this. This is Camille who found this jug. I'll tell you the story behind this. The first thing that she found was just the lip. Now, she's obviously dug down 3 or 4 inches now, just the lip. And she was very excited. We're in level 6, and we're not supposed to be digging there. And she finds this in level 6. So she pulls all of us in and says, surround me so they can't see what I'm doing. I'm going to dig this thing out. And we did. So she keeps digging. All the time she's going, well, it's going to be broken. It's going to be broken. It's going to be broken. It ended up being a full jug from the time of the Canaanites. The interesting thing that I think about this, just to put it in perspective, she is the first person to touch that jug in 3,500 years. Is that cool or what? Right? If you want to touch one, I actually have a 3,000-year-old piece of pottery they gave to us. It got broken in my suitcase on the way home. But anyway, here's a piece of pottery from Tel Lahish. That's 3,000 years old. Hers is even older. This is from King David's time. That's from even earlier. You can see the excitement in her eyes. We had to pull it out of her hands. There are some other pictures that I didn't show here, but this was a big find where Dr. Garfinkel came over and explained to us how the jug would have been used and all of that, and then scolded her for digging it up. For two reasons. One, you're not supposed to be in level 6, and two, when you find something, you're supposed to tell the archaeologist so they can take pictures of it in situ, and then you can dig it up. And we didn't do that. We kind of hid Camille to where she could do this. Anyway, my bad. Some other things that we found, animal teeth. So obviously there's, if they're going to be cooking meat, they're going to be slaughtering animals. And we found tons and tons of animal bones there. So some animal teeth, probably cow. What Colin Gwynn found on this right-hand side, you see him hold it. You can see this piece of pottery has red paint on it. That is uniquely identified as Philistine pottery. So there was some Philistine pottery that was found at level 5. Now, how did it get there? Now, who knows the story, right? Maybe we raided a Philistine city and stole some of their oil or grain or whatever and brought it back to, I say we, like I'm in the city. Sorry, I get really wrapped up in this. Who knows how it got brought back there, but there was some Philistine pottery. There was some Egyptian pottery. There are lots of different types and styles, and again, this would have been something for them to be able to know, but that was a piece of Philistine pottery. Here's a big discovery for Dan Conrad back there. So it's hard to see in this picture, but you've got a wall, a wall, a wall, and a wall, and we kept asking the questions, where's the door? Right, I mean, you've got to have a way out of this, to the point where one of the younger archaeologists was saying, well, maybe there wasn't a door. Maybe you would climb up a ladder and enter through the roof. I was like, that doesn't make any sense at all, but we're trying to figure it out. Dan found the door. And you can see this this rock down here that's had this hole kind of drilled in it, and you can see it right there. There would have, as I understand it, and Dan may have heard the story different, but there would have been one on the bottom and one on the top with a pole, and that would have been the hinge. So that was the door that we had been looking for as we were digging, and Dan was the one that found it. So kudos to Dan. This is something that I found. This is the handle of a chalice. If you know what a chalice is, the neck of the chalice, and then there's a bowl on the top for you to drink out of, and there's a bowl on the bottom for you to set. So the only thing that we could find was the neck of the chalice, but that was pretty cool. And this wasn't one of us, but another person found another juglet, but it was a little bigger than the one Claire found. It had a handle on each side. And again, the contents of Camille's large jug, Claire's small jug, and this one, they took the contents out. They're sending them to Sydney, Australia, where there's an expert there that's going to try and find biologicals in there to see if they could figure out what it was that was inside these jugs. Was it grain? Was it oil? Was it perfume? Anyway, that's something that's going to take a while to find out. All right, this is, and I'll show this in just a moment, this is where I started. You remember in that first video, there's all this bulk that's still there. We have now removed the bulk, and we have uncovered 9 rooms. Again, 9 rooms represents 5% of Tel Lachish. So there's still a whole lot out there that we don't know yet, but it was so cool to be able to go there and start with grass and end up with 9 exposed rooms. And so here's that final sweep that that I took on the last day as we were getting ready to pack it up. So there's the foundation of all 9 of the rooms, all the way down, and at the very end would be where the Canaanite temple was. So there you have it. There's what we were working on that whole time. And then I will end with this picture. Some of you may have seen this. We went up on the last day to take some final, brushing off some final stones, and then they brought a man in with a drone. And I didn't realize, I guess I should realize that they could do this, but they brought the drone in, and the drone went up and back and up and back and took hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pictures. Then with that, they stitched them together to make a 3D model. So Dr. Garfinkel will be able to have on his computer where he can like grab the screen and turn it, and he can turn the city, and he can look at it from the top and look at it from the bottom and look all around. That's something new. A few years ago, they sent a balloon up with a camera attached to it and took a picture. That was the best they had 10, 15 years ago. Now we've got drones that are going to do this for us. So there you can see some of the ruins, some of the sandbags still there. It's determined that this is going to be left as it is and will become a tourist, tourist destination or attraction. They're going to make a pathway up so that you can look down and see it, but not actually get down there to destroy stuff. And so that was kind of the end of this dig. Don't know where it will go from here. I have asked FOI if I can make a presentation to them about what we found and how much fun it was for them to determine whether this is something that we do every year, which is kind of doubtful, or every 2 years or every 5 years. Maybe FI goes to Israel in the spring, and maybe every other year we'll trade with them. I don't know yet. This was the event of a lifetime. I have to say, even at 65 and suffering from arthritis, I still will go back and swing a pickaxe again if I can get over there. So anyway, I just wanted to kind of give you an idea of what the city of Lachish was like in Bible times. Read about so much of what the history of that area did during the time of David, during the time of Hezekiah, all the way down to the Babylonian destruction, and then even the return during Nehemiah's time. So hopefully you find that interesting and enjoyed being able to see the slides of what we were able to accomplish while we were there. And again, I'll leave this up here if you want to come and touch a piece of 3,000-year-old pottery. If it breaks, don't worry about it. It's only 3,000 years old. You know, like I say, it broke when it was in my suitcase. So anyway.